on the case of Morales against Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. Sorry.
Mr. Growart.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Ames Growart for Petitioner Appellant Efrain Morales. Your Honors, in this case, the District Court did not appreciate the prejudicial effect of trial counsel's failure to investigate and properly handle two vital witnesses. Where a criminal conviction is not supported by any physical evidence, the absence of an alibi witness and the meaningful examination of the prosecution's lead witness cannot be harmless. The District Court's contrary conclusion merits reversal. Your Honors, in this case, the District Court determined that Morales' counsel was constitutionally ineffective. As a result, the only issue before the Court is whether Morales suffered prejudice as a result for counsel's failure to call an alibi witness and examine another. To demonstrate prejudice, Morales need not convince the court of his innocence. He must only show a non-negligible chance of acquittal on retrial.
Counsel, what do you think is the effect on this proceeding of the Supreme Court's decision in Harrington against Richter?
Your Honor, I don't think I've seen that case. Sorry, if you could.
It is, first, the Supreme Court's most recent decision on ineffective assistance in conjunction with the AEDPA.
Yes, Your Honor.
And second, as I understand Harrington, it expressly disapproves those portions of the district court's reasoning that were most favorable to your client. That is, the district court said it owed no deference under the AEDPA to state court decisions if the state court didn't discuss the precise issue the prisoner was raising. The Supreme Court said that was wrong. Supreme Court said it also doesn't matter whether the state court says something wrong, provided it reaches a reasonable result. Now, in both aspects, the district court agreed with you, and the Supreme Court has said, as I read Harrington, erroneously. Now, you think this might have some effect on the outcome?
Your Honors, my argument would be that even if the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act does apply, we could demonstrate that these state court judgments were unreasonable, and therefore that review may be had de novo.
Well, actually, the Supreme Court disapproved that approach, too. That's what the Ninth Circuit had done in Harrington. It had said, here's our assessment of prejudice. To the extent any assessment differs from that, it's unreasonable. The Supreme Court unanimously said that that, too, was a violation of the AEDPA.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I had actually not seen that case, although I had researched very thoroughly on the point. Our argument in reply briefing as well was that the district court's conclusion that no court before the district court had evaluated the combined prejudice of counsel's two failures, we believe that was correct, and that also necessitates approval of the de novo or usage of the de novo standard. If that is not the case, Your Honors, the state courts could in fact duck the issue of the combined prejudice of multiple witnesses and make partially unreasonable determinations on the basis of the two witnesses, and on that basis allow the federal courts to deny a writ of habeas corpus simply by combining the reasonable parts of an otherwise unreasonable decision. Your Honor, because Strickland v. Washington requires that the court look at the difference between the case as it should have been presented to the trial court and as it in fact was presented, my argument would be that Strickland v. Washington in fact requires that argument to compel the court's judgment. Your Honors, to win relief under Strickland v. Washington, petitioner need only show a non-negligible chance of acquittal. This standard is comparatively low because whereas here...
I have another question. Do you have any comment on the bearing on this proceeding of our decision in Williams against Lemon?
Your Honors, I had not seen that case either. I'm sorry.
That is our most recent case dealing with a lawyer who failed to interview an arguably relevant witness.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we said in Williams is that it's a mistake to ask whether by not interviewing witness X or witness Y, the lawyer erred. You have to evaluate not simply what the lawyer failed to do, but also what the lawyer did.
Yes, Your Honors.
So one of the things I looked for in the party's briefs in this case is a description of what the lawyer did.
Yes, Your Honors.
Was he a generally effective lawyer who failed, explicably or not, to interview these this one potential witness, or failed to take a third party along to his interview with another? Or was he a potted plant? And one can't tell from the briefs. What was he?
Your Honors, we would not say that trial counsel was a potted plant. However, I do not believe that he was effective whatsoever in this case. He did, and we are grateful for his performance at the trial court. He did manage to impeach the two Satan disciple witnesses by pointing out problems with their testimony, specifically that one was convicted of multiple drug offenses and that the other did not identify petitioner until a year and a half after the crime. However, Your Honors, his handling of the two other of the state's absolutely critical witness, and that was Katrina Simone, was patently unreasonable. The state presented at trial that Katrina Simone stated affirmatively that she was not with petitioner on the night of the crime. Callahan, trial counsel, in fact knew this to be false. He knew that her actual memory was that she could not remember whether she was with him or not. That the presentation of that issue would have given the jury something they otherwise lacked, which was a chance to disbelieve her testimony.
By the way, that there is some per se rule that every time a lawyer interviews a potential witness, there must be a third party in the room?
No, Your Honors, absolutely not. My argument would simply be...
Why was it unreasonable here? Was the unreasonable thing, or was the unprofessional behavior by the lawyer interviewing Katrina without a third party, or was it failing to interview her a second time with a third party?
Your Honor, the latter is what our argument would be. He may have learned from his first interview that she could not support a complete alibi, but he also had noticed from the felony review files that her testimony at trial would be that she knew affirmatively that she was not with Morales. The proper conduct in that case would have been to return and re-interview to present her testimony for impeachment. Your Honors, in this case, the case on collateral review has become, in the fullness of time, a completely different case. The jury lacked the chance to hear Thomas Simone's alibi testimony and the testimony of Thomas Simone and Katrina Simone herself, which would have undercut her testimony to an alleged confession. The jury was deprived of both of these grounds and heard no reason to doubt Morales' alleged confession.
How would it have undermined her testimony on the alleged confession?
Your Honors, thank you. The argument here is that she testified that she was affirmatively not with Morales on the night of the crime. If there was any doubt in her memory as to that fact, it goes to the extent she can credibly testify to a confession. If she knows and is certain that Morales confessed to her, she should also know and be certain, perforce, that she was not with Morales on the night of the crime. Those two facts are linked, in our view, and I think logic compels the same.
The confession was linked to the request for an alibi.
No, Your Honor, that's not our argument. Our argument is that her memory is a pivotal point in both whether he forced her to fabricate an alibi or was simply asking her to remember the truth, and whether she could credibly testify to a confession.
I don't know why you don't see that linkage to the alibi, I guess. I wonder if you're giving something up you shouldn't be giving up.
I see it actually is linked to the alibi in a sense, in that if Katrina had some uncertainty about whether or not she was with Morales, then that would bolster Thomas Simone's proffered alibi, if that's Your Honor's point. And in the alternative, that Thomas Simone's testimony to an alibi is in fact consistent with the argument that, or with the allegation that Katrina in fact was with Morales on the night of the crime. Does that address your point? I hope so.
Still doubtful, but go ahead.
Okay. Your Honors, in this case, trial counsel's failures obscured a potential alibi witness who both appeared in police reports and presented himself to counsel. Thomas Simone would have testified at trial that he was with Morales on the night of the crime at his house, and that he drove Morales home sometime around midnight. This alibi precludes Morales' involvement in the crime. The district court summarily disposed of Thomas Simone's testimony because the car described in his alibi does not exist in state records, and because his erroneous memory was similar to Morales' memory, suggesting fabrication. But critically, Your Honors, their memories are not identical, as respondent has conceded in briefing. The reason two witnesses' memories may converge on a similar fact are without number, especially because here, as the district court noticed, it is possible that Thomas used a car that was not described in state records. It was therefore error to jump to the conclusion of fabrication. Otherwise, this detail, evidencing a likely factual error in the alibi testimony, was a matter for retrial. Your Honor, the jury was entitled to both hear and believe Thomas Simone's alibi testimony. Despite
of course, Judge Cannelli heard testimony from both Morales and Simone, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
He made some credibility determinations.
Our argument is that the credibility determination as applied to Thomas Simone was predicated largely on this factual inconsistency.
But there was in-person testimony.
Yes, Your Honor, there was definitely in-person testimony.
So don't we have to give his credibility determination some deference?
It appears to me from the record that his credibility determination was based almost entirely on the alleged factual inconsistency. Therefore, to the extent that that was error, and it was error to jump to a conclusion of fabrication, that credibility determination would be unreasonable. He did not appear to make any credibility determination based on the record, based on tone, demeanor, etc. He said that he believed Thomas was generally not a credible witness, but again, our belief is that it linked only to the factual error in the concerning the car. Peripheral details like this, Your Honor, are matters for retrial if they do not touch the exculpatory elements of the alibi. Regardless of what color Thomas Simone drove on that night with Mr. Morales, the point is that they were together and that time together precludes any involvement in the crime here at issue. Further, the alibi was overall credible. Morales has consistently testified to this alibi since his arrest, to the point that he never even changed it, even when he was alerted by the police, by the prosecutors, that Katrina would not support the alibi. Your Honor, as I see my initial time for this point has expired, and I'd like to reserve for rebuttal, if you don't mind.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Iskowich.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Grauert, may it please the Court. My name is David Iskowich with the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the appellee respondent in this case. As we addressed in our brief, Your Honors, AEDPA certainly does apply to the state court adjudications on petitioners.
What do you think is the bearing of Harrington on this case?
Well, Harrington certainly tightened up the standard, Your Honor. With respect to the performance.
It's not a vice. Standards aren't tight or loose. That's newspaper talk. I mean, there are legal propositions in Harrington. How do you think they bear on this case?
Well, they must bear favorably in our position, Your Honor. Harrington held that state court adjudications are afforded a high level of deference and respect. That federal courts adjudicating federal claims should refrain from, in essence, conducting a de novo review and then claiming it's unreasonable and doing that backwards. With respect to its applicability to this case.
There's certainly something odd in a district court saying it was unreasonable for the state court to find no prejudice. I've now held a de novo review and I find no prejudice.
Correct, Your Honor.
So what?
Well, Judge, we do certainly contest those findings in our brief with respect to each of the ineffective assistance aspects. They are wrong. De novo review was inappropriate. With respect to the district court's emphasis on what it called the combined prejudicial effect of counsel's errors, in Morales 3, which was the last state court to adjudicate the ineffective assistance claim, the petitioner never raised the Katrina impeachment set of facts to that court. He did raise the Thomas alibi set of facts to that court. It couldn't have been unreasonable, therefore, for Morales 3 to fail to conduct a cumulative error analysis on a basis that wasn't in front of it. That being the case, we did urge in the district court that 2254 deference was appropriate. Judge Cannelli didn't buy what we were selling, but even de novo, as he said.
Did you, by the way, ever ask the district court to look at the attorney's decision with respect to these two witnesses, Thomas and Katrina, in the light of what the lawyer did for his client?
Yes, Attorney Callahan did testify.
Why did you not make such an argument on appeal? I take you to have forfeited any reliance on the principle of Williams against Lemon.
Given the trial judge's, the district court's fact findings, Your Honor, and some of the precedent from this court with respect to alibis and available alibis and even failing to investigate alibis, we felt that our stronger argument lay in the Strickland prejudice inquiry. And that's how we decided to brief.
We will take that as a formal waiver with Williams, although why the state would want to do that, I do not know.
With respect to the two lines of argument that the petitioner has set forth in his brief and before this court underlying his Sixth Amendment claim, the alibi aspect regarding Thomas, Thomas did testify in the district court, and Judge Cannelli found that he was simply not a credible witness or a credible alibi. At the outset of his discussion, in his opinion, Judge Cannelli was very clear that he looked at each witness's tone, demeanor, aspect, perceived inconsistencies, inconsistencies from their testimony that could be compared against the documentary record.
There's one inconsistency in Katrina's testimony that I just can't, I don't know whether the judge really did address clearly. It really does bother me. She said she couldn't remember whether or not the defendant was with her.
Correct.
And yet she remembers the confession.
Correct.
How could you remember the confession? He said he was out killing the guy and not remember whether you were with him or not that evening.
Correct, Your Honor. It doesn't make sense. That's why the petitioner's claim based upon that theory that impeaching Katrina on that one discrete point wouldn't have made any difference in the end. Had counsel impeached Katrina with that pretrial ambivalence that she allegedly communicated to him, the rest of her testimony would have fallen exactly into place as it does in the record. She would have still testified that he confessed to me. He called me up and wanted to meet with me to talk about it. He told me to explain and describe the interior of his home in Elmwood Park because I've never been there and that's where my alibi is. She would have testified that they got together and, in her own words, went over or practiced the story three times. Later, it would have come out that after Katrina decided to cooperate with police and the petitioner learned of this cooperation, he telephoned her repeatedly and proceeded to use profanity at her. So that's the entire point of our argument with respect to the Katrina aspect, is that impeaching her on this one very discreet point wouldn't have made a whole bit of difference with respect to the entirety of her testimony, all of which was inculpatory. And any reasonable jury sitting there listening to her say, yes, now I actually can't remember that I was with him, but I'm not retracting any of this other stuff, any reasonable jury certainly would have come to the conclusion that, well, she might not remember what was going on then with respect to whether she was with him, but obviously she wasn't with him because there's never been any allegation that she was involved in this shooting. So the fact is that that particular impeachment would have had any effect, would have had no effect on the outcome of the trial, much less any reasonable probability that the result of the trial would have been different. So that line of argument is really a non-starter. The Thomas alibi aspect is a non-starter either, mostly because of Judge Cannelli's credibility findings, which are virtually unassailable on appeal.
Suppose that Thomas had borrowed a car that night.
If Thomas had borrowed a car that night,
yeah,
then...
he was driving a white car that night. He had known one, but he borrowed it.
That would have lended a little more strength to the alibi, Your Honor. But I want to emphasize that the make and model of the vehicle, when read in context, wasn't the only point on which the district judge found Thomas to be not credible. The judge did say that he was generally not credible. There are other examples in his testimony that don't make sense. The day he was called to testify in federal court by subpoena, he didn't show up. When he showed up 3 weeks later under order by the court, he explained that the date slipped his mind. Now, remember, this is the centerpiece of petitioner's case. This is his alibi, who signed an affidavit in 1998. Attesting that he was with petitioner at the time of the shooting. When given the chance to testify to this fact in 2006, he doesn't show up to testify about it. Other parts of his testimony didn't make sense. He got dates wrong. For instance, he said he talked to petitioner on the 25th, although his affidavit shows that he talked to petitioner on the 26th. He claimed that he wasn't aware that his own daughter, Katrina, testified before the grand jury in this case, even though they were living together in Elmwood Park at the time, and he remained unaware in 2006 that Katrina, his own daughter, had even testified at petitioner's criminal trial in Cook County. All of these factors viewed as a whole certainly support district judge's decision not to assign any weight or credibility to Thomas's alibi account. When balanced against the proof that was already in the trial record, the two eyewitnesses testified that petitioner was the gunman who viewed him up close under good lighting conditions without any impediments to their view, and viewed also within the context of the remainder of Katrina's testimony, assuming that she were impeached on that very small aspect of it, there's simply no reasonable probability that the result of this trial would have been different. The petitioner does attack certain aspects of the eyewitness identifications provided by eyewitness Navarro and eyewitness Crawford. However, it bears noting that all of those perceived deficiencies were already in front of the jury. Nothing new came out at the federal evidentiary hearing regarding the veracity of those witnesses that was admissible proof. Those factual findings and those transcripts and the facts contained in those transcripts are not assailable at this point in the proceedings and must be viewed in their entirety and along with the proof developed at the evidentiary hearing that, as discussed, simply didn't make the grade for showing prejudice. There are no further questions on any of these points, Your Honors. We request that the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further?
Yes, Your Honor, please.
Sir, before you launch into your rebuttal, your view of the situation with Katrina. Why isn't the government correct that if she did not remember whether she was there or not, how could she possibly have recognized? I have difficulty seeing how she could possibly have remembered this confession. They say that really supports their side of the case. What's your view?
Your Honor, I think your view on the case is correct, or on that point specifically.
I don't have a view yet. I'm trying my darndest to find out what you guys think about this. Frankly, you circumlocuted me the first time, I thought. That's why I'm asking you for a question now to answer that.
Okay. My argument on that point, and which I would wish you all, hope you all would credit, is that if she does not have any memory of whether she was with Morales on the night of the crime, she certainly cannot testify credibly to a confession. And therefore, that part of the testimony would in fact fall away, would have fallen away in the eyes of the jury. I hope that is a better answer for that question.
It is.
Thank you. Your Honor, also a respondent argued in his time here that Katrina's uncertainty would not have done away with the rest of her testimony, but we think that is erroneous. Although it does appear from the record that Katrina and Morales may have rehearsed their testimony together, the problem with that point is that there are a number of reasons that you could go over a story you're going to tell. It could even be true. If I am trying to make sure that a story is presented credibly, even though I know it is true, I would in fact rehearse that testimony with the person I was going to give it with. A simple rehearsal does not provide evidence of falsity. The jury would have been entitled to draw the identical conclusion. Your Honor, I wanted to apologize as well for missing those two Supreme Court cases that you raised to me on my argument. If you wished it done, I would be happy to offer supplementary briefing on those cases which you do not believe respondent has waived.
Well, Williams against Lemon is a decision of this circuit. I've mentioned only one Supreme Court case. That's Harrington against Richter. And although I don't think we need to direct the parties to file supplemental memos about the effect of Harrington, if you wish to do so, either side can do so within 7 days.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to raise some other points as well. Respondent has argued that the Morales III court was not given a chance, or was not given a chance to pass on the issue of any error that flowed from Katrina Simone, or the handling of Katrina Simone. This is in fact false. If you look at the Morales III decision, the Morales III court confronted Katrina Simone's testimony and said trial counsel had no reason to believe in 1996 that Katrina would equivocate in 1998. That's supplemental appendix page 1007. That is a handling of the Katrina issue. It is unreasonable, however, because they fail to actually appreciate Morales' argument as related to Katrina Simone's testimony. Another point I'd like to raise is a respondent spent some time assailing Thomas Simone's credibility generally as a result of failure to appear for court dates and failure to remember specific points. But, Your Honors, this is a case where we're before this court today, 15 years after the trial, 17 years after the crime. Thomas was allowed to forget incidental details like dates, etc. Also, Your Honors, Thomas Simone's alibi was that he would have been doing drugs with Petitioner Morales. Therefore, to the extent that he fails to appear for court dates, that's largely consonant with the concern or with the proffered alibi testimony. I see I'm out of time, Your Honors, but I'd I wanted to argue to you for reversal on the ground that the jury was entitled to hear and believe Thomas Simone's alibi testimony, and the jury was deprived, erroneously, of any reason to doubt Katrina's testimony. And the eyewitnesses do not support conviction alone. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Counsel, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client.
Your Honor, it's a pleasure.
The case is taken under advisement.